It's the 4th of May, 2025. This is our waxing moon, rising moon, lunar observance day, half moon rising. It's a week away to Visakha Puja, and the feels like the monastery is in full swing. The guest scene is in full swing, people coming and going. It's a stark contrast to our winter retreat, which ended at the end of March, and then also up and coming Longpa Liam visit, arriving at Bayagiri on the evening of May 16th and staying here until about mid-morning May 21st. That's the plan anyway, subject to much uncertainty and change. And the springtime is very beautiful here for anybody who's had the opportunity to spend some time outside and walk on the trails on your own, spend some time in solitude. And in the morning, we have the birds singing and building their nests, and then the evening crickets and the evening insects, and just can use these external conditions to keep the mind in a state of peace, a state of normality, normalcy. And that's very, very important when it comes to practice. And the longer we practice, the more we find that really that's all that it really matters. That's all that's important, is keeping the mind just even and in a state, in a normal state. It's not about getting to some very exalted state, but just even and ordinary. And then if you spend time with some of these great Ajahns in Thailand, you find that that's what they're focusing on, that's what they're stressing, is that keeping the mind even. Of course, there'll be times when there is more focused states of calm and where the mind settles in a very natural way, and that's great, that's wonderful when that happens. But then we have to take that and make use of it during the day and just keep ourselves in a very even, normal state. And the more we do that, the more we'll gain benefit from the practice. And that's our baseline samadhi. So the more focused samadhi might be during our sitting or walking meditation, then the baseline samadhi is where the heart, that baseline that the heart doesn't drop below. So that's where it's going to start to get mixed up with panya, with wisdom. And the mindfulness has to be there directing it all the time. So if we're just looking at the breath and the mind is becoming very, very still and settled, but we never use that, we never couple that with the mindfulness to direct it toward things like uncertainty and impermanence and constancy and insight, then we're not really making much use of it. But if we are able to direct it toward insight, that specifically that insight into impermanence, then we're able to make very good use of it. And then the mind will be able to let go of all sorts of things that it couldn't let go of before. So for example, anger, irritation, annoyance, greed, desire for gain, desire for praise, fear of criticism, all sorts of fears, fear of the unknown, all these things can start to drop away when we couple the sati with the samadhi and get the panya, the wisdom, the discernment. Then we're really able to benefit from just listening to the crickets. We're really able to appreciate being on our own and spending time in solitude, and really able to dive into whatever practice we might want to engage in that's in line with the Buddha's teachings. So this is the way of peace that we try to practice in the monastery. And this is in stark contrast to just getting involved with the world and getting involved with all sorts of fear of the future and anxiety and all sorts of dissatisfaction in relation to the world outside. But then we just come back to being peaceful. That's our duty as practitioners. That's what's important. So sometimes when we run up against obstacles in our practice, say there's a big life decision that's looming, we can't stop thinking about it. Maybe we're looking forward to getting divorced or having kids, or our kids aren't growing up the way we thought they should, and they have all sorts of problems in their lives, or we just we have some sort of cancer diagnosis. So there's all sorts of things that come up that might occupy our mind and really keep it from being able to be peaceful. So there's no shortage of things that come up. But then we can actually use these insights, we can use the Buddhist teachings to reflect that these are just really normal parts of the human condition. So if we practice virtue, there's nothing to fear in terms of death. We don't need to fear that, because for one who is virtuous, there's no worries, there's no problems, there's no remorse, there's no regrets. So there's no fear of death. But for one who is unvirtuous, death is scary, because there's all sorts of unresolved things. And this is what we call kamma, or in Sanskrit, karma. There's all these unresolved debts that are going to come back to us. And the debts all have to be paid at some point. We could think of kamma as a debt. We could think of unskillful or unwholesome kamma, say like unskillful actions we may have done in the past, things we may have regretted doing. We may have done harm to somebody, for example, and that debt has to be paid at some point. And on the flip side, there's good kamma, there's wholesome, the results of wholesome, skillful actions, and then that's a boon, that's a surplus, and that also comes back to us. And we also can't stop that from coming back to us. It's like the Buddha's teaching, where the Buddha talks about if one creates the causes for Nibbana, even if one has the wish, may I not attain Nibbana, then one would still attain it if you've planted the causes for it. Those causes will ripen according to nature. That's just the natural truth of things. So even if you were to say, no, I don't want to attain Nibbana until all sentient beings, I want to save all sentient beings. But if you've created those wholesome, skillful causes for Nibbana, then that's what has to happen. Or if we wish, may I attain Nibbana, then, but we don't plant the causes for it, then no matter how much we wish it, it doesn't come about by wishing. These things don't come about by just wanting them, by wishing for them, and we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. So just to knuckle down, get down to the practice, that's all we have to do. We don't really have to think about the results, most of us have seen enough to verify at least some of the Buddha's teachings, and that's enough to just say, okay, I can have confidence in this, and I'm just going to get down to the practice and for as long as it takes, and not think about the results, and just see, just keep going. That's one of the most common advices the Thai Ajahns end up giving, is just do you have any advice for me as a monk starting to become more senior? And the advice would be, Bai Lu Lui, keep going. Bai Lu Lui, just keep going. So that's a lot. That's really all there is to it. The other really common advice is Ot Ton. So just endure, have some patient endurance. Or you get Lungpa Liam, Hai Ot Ton Noi. Like, come on, just endure a little. It's not a big deal. We can actually go without a little, we can endure a little, and that'll be for our benefit. And the one who has patient endurance, the one who has kanti, or what we say in Thai, oton, the one who has that is always happy, has that sense of well-being and happiness. Or we could think of it as people who know how to do things themselves, people who know how to make things themselves, people who know how to look after things on their own. They're always happy because they know how to solve all sorts of problems. They're not dependent on other people to have to solve their problems. So when we develop skill, we can solve all sorts of problems for ourselves, and then there's no need to have any sense of worry, and there's no problem. It's not, this or that person didn't do that, so got to go call them to come do that, but we can go do it ourselves. Like if we want to eat rice, if we're hungry for rice, then we shouldn't really look for someone else. We should plant some rice. This is an old Thai saying that if you want to eat rice, go plant a field. don't ask for it for somebody else. So it's looking at our own efforts and what can we do with our own efforts. So of course, there's this interdependence where we are all dependent on each other. We all assist each other. We all help each other out. But then there's also an independence where we can actually be self-reliant within that. And when we all cultivate that, then there's really wonderful. Then we have an incredible community, a foundation for our little society here at Abhayagiri. So when we all have that sense of self-reliance, then we can truly rely on each other. We can truly be of assistance to others. So for the last 9 weeks or so, I've been dealing with some painful sensations, some sciatic nerve pain, and I've received a lot of assistance, a lot of help from others. But I also have to rely on myself for this, so it's kind of a reflection that's coming up for me. So during the there's physical therapy I have to do that if I do it, it'll benefit me. But it's not that easy with my current duties in the monastery and fairly busy schedule to keep it going. So I've been getting up after the chanting and going and doing my PT and then finishing with some walking meditation. I've been doing that in the mornings and the evenings. So doing it twice a day, that makes it very consistent. I'm able to do it at the same time each day. And there's a demarcated time for doing it, and then trying to make the physical therapy into a meditation. Of course, noticing the unpleasant sensations in the body as I'm undergoing this physical therapy. And now this is, for this kind of thing, then this can be a great blessing, because it just reminds us this is the nature of the body, this is just how it is. And to not think that we're going to have to undergo things or experience things like this is a very unrealistic expectation. So to expect to not experience pain and discomfort and sickness and old age and death, ultimately, these are all unrealistic expectations. So a more realistic expectation would be to say, okay, well, these all are inevitable experiences. No matter what age I am, these are all inevitable. This aging, sickness, death, these are all inevitable, so how can we prepare the mind for this, to be able to let go of this? And there's a sense of humility involved in that, and there's a sense of courage. So can I make the mind peaceful when there's unpleasant sensation? You know, is that possible? Because easily the mind could go toward, oh, this is dragging on, and it's not getting resolved, and no matter what I do, none of the treatments seem to be fast enough. But I have to admit, it is slowly, slowly getting better. But it's actually, or I could take the view that this is just nature, and it's teaching me this is how the body is, and it can't really be any other way. There's all sorts of systems in the body. There's nerves and muscles, and who knows what's all going on in there, what the real source of the problem or the source of the problems is. And it's just a matter of looking at the sensations, seeing what can be done, but then not really having any expectations that it's going to get cured really quickly or that it's just going to go away. Even if it does go away, there's going to be some other unpleasant sensation in the future. So to be able to be at peace with just what's occurring, this is just nature. This is just a natural phenomenon that is normal. Bodies are like this. They experience these things. These things are all inherent within us. And that's what the Buddha is pointing to. That's the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha's not saying, you know, go out of your body. He's saying, stay in the body. It's very clear in the Kayagatasati Sutta, where the Buddha's talking about the whole sutta dedicated to just mindfulness of the body, that those who remember mindfulness of the body are close to the deathless. Those who forget mindfulness of the body are far from the deathless. So that's the mindfulness rooted in the body. So he's saying, stay in the body, look at the body, look at this fathom-long body. This is from the soles of the feet up to the crown of the head. This is what we have to work with, these ordinary things. And it's almost laughable, it's almost crazy to think that contemplating these ordinary things, contemplating the true nature of the body, is what leads to liberation. It's actually the thing that leads to enlightenment, is just contemplating the ordinary nature of the body, the unattractive ordinary nature of the body, And the Buddha didn't, in the suttas, the Buddha doesn't say like develop revulsion or, well, he does kind of say develop revulsion, but not aversion toward the body. He says, see the insides of the body as something ordinary. It's like opening up a bag and different types of beans spill out. There's mung beans, there's kidney beans, there's different types of beans, there's green beans, there's red beans, and these different beans spill out when you open the bag. So just so one sees that there's hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, muscles, sinews, bones, bone marrow, and so on. Seeing that this is just something ordinary, that's one part of mindfulness of the body. Another part of mindfulness of the body is death. The body ends at some point. Even if we're able to use science to prolong it for even 1,000 years, then it would still pass away at some point. You see these signs, or I don't know if you see them now, maybe people have realized it's not really good to expect these things, but I remember a few years ago seeing like an advert, like the first person to live to be 1,000 has already been born. You know, this kind of, this like getting intoxicated with scientific achievement. And I just remember thinking like, God, if you could live to be 1,000, that would be so miserable. You'd be miserable. You'd get to be 100 and then you'd just be miserable for 900 years. And then you would die. It would just be so awful to live to be 1,000. And science does have some amazing things about it, like thinking Ajahn Kurudamo with his surgery where they have to stop the heart for a period of time and repair it. That's just unbelievable that they can do that and that you can live through it. So there are some amazing things, that amazing advancements, modern advancements in the world. But then those basic truths, they never change. The Akaliko Dhamma, the Dhamma that never changes. It's true at any time in history, any time in society, that the body will die at some point. So that's the next part of body mindfulness, is the charnel ground contemplations. What happens when the body dies? Well, in the old days, or even in present day, in some countries, in some places, the body will be cast aside in a charnel ground, and it will degenerate in various ways, and it will become bloated, and various bacteria and maggots and worms will feast on it, and eventually it will pop and all the juices will flow out, and then there'll be bones, and there'll be bones spattered with blood, and then over time their bones will dry out and will be connected by sinews, and then the sinews will dry out, and then the bones will be just scattered here and there, and eventually they rot away to dust. And so that's just the nature of the body. So those contemplations, that's an entry into not self, just imagining one's own body. And this is not inauspicious. This is not bad. This is not a bad thing to do. This is very, very wholesome, very skillful. If it makes us depressed, then we need to tone it down a bit and temper it with metta. But if it has the proper result is a great cooling of the heart, and the heart cooling down and coming to a state of peace. This is just the nature of things, and can I fully accept it? If I can, then the heart becomes very, very cool. And that imagining one's own body dissolving into bones and eventually dust is a great way to enter into a contemplation of not self. This is all it is. It doesn't belong to, it's not me, not mine. It's just elements according to nature. So that's another part of body mindfulness. Also, we can think of it as elements, just different elements making up, comprising the body. So there's the earth element, water element, fire element, and air element. And there's various ways to think about this. We could think about it as different qualities. So earth element being those things that are solid in the body, water element as those things that are liquid in the body, air element as, say, wind, like motion in the body, the breath, but also subtle wind energies in the body, and the breath entering into the blood and the wind energy in the blood, the movement of the blood through the body, circulation, and the fire, which is the, you could think of it as the life force of the body, the heat element in the body, the temperature regulation of the body, the homeostasis of the body. Or if we're more scientific-minded, we could think of it as that any elements in the periodic table of elements are in one of three states. They're either earth, i.e. solid, they're either water or liquid, they're either air, meaning gas, and then fire. The temperature is what, temperature and pressure is what dictates which state any element is in at any given time, whether it's a solid, liquid, or a gas. It's dependent upon the fire element. It's dependent on temperature. So if we're more scientific-minded, we could think of it that way. And if that helps us to contemplate the body. And sometimes, I know I've had this question before, although nobody's asked this question in a while, but I know in the past few as well, you know, dispassion for the body, that doesn't, what about this kind of wonder and amazement with the body, just how amazing it is that it actually functions and works. It's a miracle. And that's true. It is. It is. And it still dies. It still dies, which that's just, no matter, it is miraculous that it actually works. It's totally amazing that there's so many systems in the body that could break down at any time. It is amazing that we are able to stay alive as long as we do. But then it does end. So thinking about these things, the mind can really start to settle within them. And this is the practice that we do in the monastery. When the mind settles on these things and there's a sense of no worries, no problems, no issues, there's a sense that the mind doesn't want to pick things up, then there's going to be a natural sense of goodwill, friendliness. That's also a natural result of the cooling of the heart and friendliness and a desire to just want to help out, want to be there for each other. It's just a very natural result of the practice. So these are some themes I've been reflecting on, mostly because I've been listening to some Lhompa Liam talks and preparing for his visit, and having a lot of appreciation for his style of teaching. And there is one story which illustrates this kind of friendliness. And sometimes, you know, when, if you're not familiar with the monastery or you're new to seeing monks, we might have various ideas about monks that, you know, maybe they'll be critical of me or judgmental of me. They might think, oh, you know, who is this person? Or that they might think, yeah, this person really needs to be told off. But actually, that's, if we have that sense of friendliness as monks, if we have that sense of coolness and friendliness, that's certainly not the case. When I was a junior monk, I was way more judgmental than I am now, because I didn't get it yet. I wasn't getting it. So I was very critical and judgmental. They're not keeping the precepts. I remember, this is kind of really laughable now, but being out visiting people and then, like, they're smacking their lips when they eat. That's against the precepts. Oh, wait, they're lay people. I'm at their home. Why am I getting judgmental about this? Like, this is what we do in the monastery. I don't really care about that kind of thing now. They're drinking. They shouldn't be doing that. But now it's, oh, well, that's just, everybody just does their thing. There's no sense of judgment about it. Just friendliness, just a wish to help. So there was a monk back in the day who disrobed, and he was a very good monk. This was years and years ago, before I even came here. Probably it was probably after I was born, but not that long after I was born. Maybe I was like 8 years old or something when this happened. But a good story. There was a monk who was, he was part of the Western monks community, and he's a disciple of Ajahn Chah, and decided eventually he was going to disrobe. And he'd been a monk for 10 or 11 years, I think. And, but he went to disrobe with Lhompa Liam, who was a bit more junior than he was the abbot of Wat Pepong already. I believe Longpocha had passed away at that point, or at least was very, very ill. And he was really scared of going to disrobe with Ajahn Liam, because Ajahn Liam was this kind of very, very silent monk at that time. Almost never spoke. I mean, he doesn't speak much now, but then it was much, even less. And so you think, oh, he's going to really blast me when I go to disrobe. He's going to be like, what the hell are you doing? So he went to disrobe with, he went to Thailand, went to disrobe with Ajahn Liam. And so Ajahn Liam just greeted him with great friendliness and said, hello, you know, okay, yeah, that's fine, no problem. And so it went through the disrobing, and then he's kind of like, oh, I was so scared, and he was so kind to me. And so then he asked Ajahn Liam, he's like, oh, I thought you were going to try to get me to stop, or that you were going to blast me, or, and you know, why, you know, but you were just friendly to me. You were just took me in, and you allowed me to disrobe with you, and now I'm a layperson, and I'm just blown away by this. And then Ajahn Liam just said, I'm saying Ajahn because he was the Ajahn then, he wasn't Longpa yet at that point. He said, yeah, yeah, that's Ajahn Chah's teaching. He told us to be nice to each other. So just very, very basic. He's like, yeah, we're, just, you know, he taught us to be nice to each other. So that's what I do. So I think with that, that's probably good for the amount of time given this evening. And I think I'll just leave it there for now.